You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on October 11th, 2015, at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Kelly and Nate join me to discuss the Reagan Revolution's continued influence on both parties, the U.S. hospital airstrike in Kunduz, Afghanistan, and the end of the venerable Perkins Student Loan Program. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio this week is Nate, as usual. Welcome back, Nate.
Thanks, Bill.
And on the line with me from Washington, D.C. is Kelly. Kelly, welcome back.
Thanks, Bill.
Okay, so last week, for those who heard last week's episode, Nate and I were talking about U.S. elections. We were talking about the, you know, various Republican figures. We were talking about Bernie Sanders on the left and Hillary Clinton and all that. And the sort of theme that I think that we left things off at the end was this point about some progressives being trapped in kind of the same framework that the, you know, conservatives have embraced, which is this sort of framework established by Reagan. And this is a bit of a controversial concept. Somebody got very upset with me on social media because she thought that I was accusing her of being a Reaganite when she was a progressive or whatever. And it's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying these progressives like believe in, you know, the Reagan philosophies per se. It's that Reagan has sort of set the terms of the debate that continues to this day. And there is some sort of political science support for this as well. There's a guy, Stephen Skowronek. I think I probably have brought him up on the show before. This was somebody we had to read when I was in college. And I think I was a little bit skeptical at the time that this was, you know, a valid theory. But the further I get away from it, the more I start to think this might actually be true. So his thing was, this is the book, The Politics Presidents Make. And his sort of central theory was that, you know, you have one president who sort of totally shakes up American politics completely and, you know, reframes all the terms of how people think about everything. And then for, you know, probably a generation or so after that, every presidential candidate is either running to basically continue this, reinforce this, you know, try to present some sort of compromise version of it, or is trying to completely overthrow this dynamic and, you know, initiate the next big sort of mini revolution in American political thinking. So it's really easy to see with Reagan, that's like a great one to look at because you got the two terms of Reagan. Then you've got George H.W. Bush, his vice president, essentially running to sort of continue the work that Reagan had started. And then you have Bill Clinton under this theory is not, you know, this disruption against the Reaganism. He's actually continuing it, sort of a milder version, but basically a concession to that, saying that this is the world that Reagan built and this is the world that I have to operate in. And then you have George W. Bush trying to like really push off, you know, an even stronger version of it. And then you have, you know, even arguably President Obama, people thought maybe he was going to be a transformative figure. Some, you know, critics argue that he has essentially fallen into the same mold. So that's the basic tenets of this theory. And so I wanted to kind of discuss that and discuss, you know, whether or not some progressives have kind of bought into some of that framing as well. I actually found an article from The Globalist, where I work, that I hadn't read before. This was, I frequently on this show, I've quoted George R. Tyler, former U.S. Treasury Department economist, and he was talking about some, you know, proposal that Hillary Clinton had brought up, but he made several points that I think really underscore this idea that I'm talking about. So he's talking about, you know, various proposals on wage stagnation and so forth. And, you know, it says, few quibble with the problem and a host of constructive solutions have surfaced. Good ideas all, but they share a common framework provided by Reaganomics, in which returns to labor are ultimately dictated by market forces. And he's talking about various, you know, proposals and everything. But he says the salad bar of all these proposals contain no market disruptors, the essential ingredient to restoring middle class prosperity. The reforms are offered within the conceptual framework provided by Reaganomics that eschews market disruptors. American middle class prosperity is being held hostage by Reaganomics only when reforms offered by Democrats move beyond that conceptual framework. By linking wages to productivity, can its prospects brighten? Now, that's a topic we've talked about plenty of times on the show before. But I think that his point is well taken about this idea that even Democrats have gotten, many Democrats have gotten trapped in this way of thinking. So, Nate, I want to go to you first, because we did talk about this a little bit last week. What are some thoughts that you've had since our episode last week about this?
Right. Well, to just mention, go back to the first Bush presidency, George H.W. Bush. I always thought it was interesting how one of the big talking points around sort of his failures there was, you know, the whole read my lips, no new taxes thing, and then he has to institute some tax reforms. And I forget exactly how Clinton attacked him on that. I'm guessing he wasn't, you know, preaching he was going to cut taxes, you know, ridiculously himself, but Clinton definitely ran on sort of that free market premise, and anytime a politician goes back on his word on something like taxes, I mean, that opens himself up to attack there. So it's interesting to see in which sort of this pro free market dynamic instituted by Reagan has, you know, sort of transcended party lines in some respects. So you've got Democrats sort of angling to be on the right side of it versus the Republicans who traditionally are on that normal side of it. So that's just one sort of instance where this sort of had played out. Obviously, we're talking about many years ago at this point, but it is, I guess, still kind of instructive to how potentially this could continue going forward. And obviously, like you said, the Clinton presidency was very much triangulation and trying to fit Democratic, ideas and priorities into the Reagan framework, and, you know, trying to pursue this sort of third way between Democrats and Republicans that wasn't always the most successful.
And I think, just for clarity, because I didn't really define it earlier, I think that in addition to the sort of Reaganomics supply side emphasis, the other sort of core ideological philosophy of the Reagan revolution is that phrase that he used, you know, in speeches and in the debate, which is that, you know, the worst words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help, right? This idea of basically mocking the idea that government should have any role in anything, or that government can be a positive force for anything in society. And then you get that sort of exaggerated version under George W. Bush, of saying, like, you know, that we should dismantle the government as far as possible. I mean, there were certain areas where he maybe increased the government, but a lot of it was basically, and the, you know, people in Congress helping him with this, of let's chronically underfund all the executive agencies and regulatory, you know, branches and stuff, and make everything just grind to a halt and stop working. So the Reagan version is government is bad. And then, you know, it evolves into the people executing this vision long after Reagan is out of the White House, of saying, we're actively going to prevent governance from happening. We're going to try to, like, roll everything back. Kelly, your thoughts on all of this?
I think this is a really interesting way to frame it, because over the past couple of months, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the misrepresentation of Reagan in many respects. And the National Immigration Forum actually ran, I think, a very interesting and effective ad quoting Reagan in his own words, his views on immigration, and sort of juxtapositioning it with what Republicans are saying now, Republicans who claim to be, you know, the second coming of Reagan. So I think that is interesting, but I think that this is, as you're saying, is even sort of a bigger issue, is that now on both sides, left and right, everybody is sort of trying to fall in line with Reagan, and there isn't as much big picture thinking or big ideas, you know, really an opportunity for some sort of creative policy propositions, because they're all trying to fall into this box which has been created. And I think a lot of that probably has to do with just the sort of efficiency of these tax sound bites and these free market sound bites, and what the American people have become accustomed to hearing, what has been tested on a million different sort of opinion groups, and what politicians can very calculatedly will know what will work with their base. But I think that it would be refreshing to hear not only new opinions on these same Reagan topics, but just also some new opinions on some new topics, to bring in some of that fresh life and big picture thinking on both sides. It's just fascinating to me, sort of as a human interest story almost, why Reagan is revered the way he is, and why so many politicians are trying to, you know, be him, or, you know, be just like him.
Right. Well, I think you raise a good point here, which is this idea of Reagan himself versus the, as I mentioned, the people executing Reagan's vision after he's gone. And this also ties back into something that I think we briefly mentioned at the tail end of the last episode, which relates to sort of the generational interpretations of this. So again, it lasts for a generation, so on and so forth. And there's this question of, you know, not just the people who were, you know, fully formed adults with their own opinions and everything when Reagan took office, but also the people who were sort of raised by Reagan, so to speak, right? Which tends to be the Gen Xers. Now, I know you can get into a little bit of fuzzy definitions about where different generations begin and end, but fundamentally, a lot of people in what we call Generation X were either old enough to remember Reagan, or they were actually just starting to vote. But basically, a lot of them, really, their sort of worldviews politically were formed in that cauldron. Now, many of them became, you know, conservatives. They became Republicans, right? And they openly align with Ronald Reagan. You know, we hear all those stories of people like, I think even like Jason Chaffetz, right, who's a Republican, very conservative Republican from Utah. He's a relative of Mike Dukakis. And, you know, he and quite a few people from that sort of age cohort, they all were Democrats in the 1970s and then, you know, switched over to being hardcore Republicans in the 1980s in their, you know, maybe second or third elections as voting members of the American population. And now, remember, people like him are in Congress. People like him are not alone in Congress. There's a lot of those folks in Congress. And Reagan was constrained by the fact that he had a Democratic Congress and that he was really on that leading edge of pushing that conservative ideology. Now, fast forward several decades, we are in that world that he, you know, opened up for those conservatives, and we are now being, our government is now being run by those conservatives. So they have a lot of control, but then this is the really interesting element to me, which is the progressives from that same age group. Now, I think a lot of them are, you know, apathetic. That's a common trope that has been applied to Generation X. This is not me just saying this. This is a long-standing thing that far more than, you know, the millennials or any other generation, that Generation X was characterized by some amount of apathy. But let's look at the people who actually do show up. They vote regularly. They're actively involved. Maybe they're even elected officials themselves, but they are from the left, right? Some of them are the Clinton types, and they're, you know, fully committed to the triangulation vision, right? Or they're like, oh, we've talked about over in Britain, the Blairites, who think that, you know, it's impossible to win an election in a fundamentally conservative country. And they, you know, they just go in preconceding the entire notion that you could have a liberal or progressive vision in the country, right? So those are the Clinton types. But then I think there's the people who say, I agree with all your goals, right? I'm a progressive. I agree with all your goals, but it will never happen. You know, for 30 years, it's been just horrible misery, and the best we can hope for is essentially table scraps. And that is really frustrating to me. I get where they're coming from, right? Because they have experienced all of this. They've experienced the, you know, the sort of lukewarm Clinton years as this golden age, right? Relative to like this hardcore version under, you know, George W. Bush, or a almost as hardcore version under Reagan himself. I want to know what you guys think about this notion, though, of these progressives who have allowed themselves to be boxed in completely on what is actually possible. Nate.
Yeah, I think there was one good instance of this that we saw in the past couple years, or I guess the past decade, and that was sort of the civil unions thing. I mean, you had a proposal that was sort of, you know, trying to bridge the gap, I guess, on the very divisive issue of same-sex marriage, and it was basically people trying to create a second class of citizens. That's sort of what they were doing. They didn't like to phrase it that way or frame it that way. But they were trying to set up, okay, let's get the equal rights, you know, for same-sex couples, but let's not call it something like fundamental that actually has legal implications in the U.S. law code. We're just not going to call it marriage in order to, what, make religious people feel better? Like, there was no, like, real reason to actually have a, you know, medium option there, and then they sort of just continue, and that was a mainstream Democratic talking point for a while, but you know, eventually it sort of got subsumed. And you know, this was a common theme on a lot of these sort of middle ground Democratic topics, such as, okay, for example, let's talk about the war in Iraq. A lot of Democrats supported the war in Iraq, and it was pretty much cheered for by certain segments of the, you know, middle sort of hawkish wing of the Democratic Party. Of course, Lieberman was a, you know, very prominent, you know, obviously he was not a Democrat at the end of it, but, you know, we're talking about a certain segment of the party that is very, you know, concerned with trying to, you know, not appear too liberal at any cost, and then not, you know, make sure that they were not in any way trying to upset, in a lot of ways, the Reagan status quo. And that's sort of what a lot of more progressive types and people that, you know, sort of did not grow up during that Reagan era, younger and older, you know, they sort of came together in what we call the grassroots or netroots movement and started, you know, trying to take back the party from these more moderate Reagan-influenced Democrats, and eventually, you know, sparked a pretty large sea change within the Democratic Party, to the point where a lot of these more Reagan-influenced people are no longer necessarily figureheads making decisions. Maybe they're still working, you know, within the party, and some of those conservative limitations are, you know, are apparent. But at the same time, there's definitely been a shift, even within the last, you know, 5-10 years.
I am gonna play devil's advocate for a second. I do believe that sort of the best thing for America is when there are people on the right and then people way on the left, and they come together and find some common ground. I think that Democrats in the past, in recent history, have, you know, tried very hard to be the voice of reason in a political discussion that increasingly lacks reason. And while I would like, in some ways, I feel that we have been left out because the right has gone farther and farther and farther towards the right, and we have attempted to sort of, you know, show the middle way for the American people, so we haven't, you know, pushed any huge left ideas. I also in no way would like to see Democrats become, you know, so far to the left that they sort of lose their title as the voice of reason. I think increasingly Americans are beginning to see an error in sort of the Freedom Caucus and on the Republican side. And while I would like to see a push for more leftist ideas, you know, I don't want to have this huge race to the left that we've seen that's been happening on the right. I just want to throw that out there in order to play devil's advocate. However, I do think that liberals need to come together and decide what's worth fighting for, and, you know, go and fight for it and stop. I mean, Democrats like to be compared to Reagan, too, to be honest. So I think it's an interesting discussion about needing to get some more progressive out-of-the-box ideas But I do think that Democrats are increasingly appealing to many Americans just because they sound reasonable. And I would like to make sure that we maintain that.
Just on the thing about Obama and Reagan, I remember there was an interview where Obama was, you know, sort of positively comparing himself to Reagan. And I guess, you know, in terms of you wanted to project that charisma and, you know, sort of the Hollywood style. And I guess also, I guess people, I guess, think of Reagan as sort of like a calm statesman, you know, I guess. And he, I guess Obama wanted to project that as well. But basically, it, also along the lines of his politics, and we've seen from Obama is that he's actually fairly conservative in terms of his approach necessarily. Like, he's not jumping into these like massive projects, you know, rather than generally seems to be working rather incrementally. I mean, there have been some issues, like obviously healthcare, that he's launched a big initiative, but at the same time, it's not been a lot of that. It's been more, okay, let's try to get these programs in place and move from there. So, you know, as you mentioned before, Bill, even Obama, and even in this current era of where Democrats are trying to be more progressive, you still have some of these mindsets imposed by the Reagan era.
Right. And but even, I mean, to that point, like his big initiative with Obamacare, that's fundamentally the Republican approach to health reform.
Right.
I mean, that was, you know, beyond just Romney Care. I mean, this was originally devised to be the Republican compromise, was that you would have this sort of private insurance oriented market-based system. Similarly, we saw, you know, cap and trade. That's literally from the George H.W. Bush administration for dealing with acid rain. And that's instead of doing a carbon tax or something like that, right? That was the approach preferred for climate action under the Obama administration. But I do want to push back a little bit, though, Kelly, on some of what you're saying, just because I want to kind of tease out some of the nuances here. So I'm someone who definitely is a little bit skeptical of this sort of like reasonableness I mean, that's the word you used, but I think it risks being confused with what I call the cult of moderation, which is where there are some Americans, many journalists, and even many politicians who think that identifying as a moderate is like the goal. Right. Not just, oh, I want compromise, but literally that being in the middle is the preferable place to be. And I, you know, I push back on that contention. But I'm also just not quite sure on what you're defining as like too far to the left, because, again, I mean, a lot of that is has been defined for us by Republicans, by the Reaganites, by the Gen X Reaganites. And so I want to know what you think, how you would describe being too far to the left. Like, how far to the left would be too far in your opinion?
Yeah, you're helping me sort of tease out my own ideas here. Willingness to compromise. I think what I feel most frustrated about recently in American politics is this unwillingness to compromise. And so I think ideally I would vote for a candidate at any level that had pretty leftist ideas and, you know, big visions for the country and for changes that can be made, but at the end of the day was willing to sit down and with the other side and make compromises in order to move things forward. And I think that, we're going to talk about the Perkins loan a little bit later, and that comes up there as well. But I'm sick of like the government almost shutting down, you know, every couple of months. And I would like a strong leader who stands up for their beliefs and fights for them. I'm not impressed by, you know, all of these game players that we see on the right who are willing to risk people's livelihoods and, quite honestly, the safety and well-being of our country in order to, you know, have their moment of glory. And so when I talk about being reasonable, I talk about being professional and mature and human and willing to make compromises while still maintaining your ideals and big ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of that's a tactical thing rather than an ideological thing, but But at the same time, I mean, it's hard to make that case of we have to remain willing to engage in compromises when you can't compromise with people who've gone completely off the deep end. I mean, like, it's very difficult to say let's find a compromise with people who've completely just lost it. And I know, you know, obviously we need to keep the government running and everything, but it depends on what they're asking for. I mean, you can't just go to any extreme to get a deal because, I mean, I think that's part of the problem here is sort of just saying, like, in, you know, being unwilling to call out the other side. I say, look, these guys are being completely unreasonable. They're taking this hostage, and our positions that we're offering are reasonable and supported by a majority of the American people, and they're reasonable fundamental principles. And that's what I'm that's where I'm having some trouble sort of on the application
side. I agree 100% with all those statements. I would see the left sort of remain the adults at the table and say, hey, we are being reasonable. This is what we're offering the American people. When the Freedom Caucus works out, gets out whatever out of their system they need to get out, come back to the table, we'll be sitting here. I just don't want to see us try to go, you know, tick for tack with them. I agree 100% with everything you just said. I would just like to sort of remain, you know, sort of we're at the table when you're ready to meet us back here.
All right, final point on this topic before we go to a break. I want to circle back again to this sort of Gen X element that I talked about earlier. On this show, it's a millennial show. We make no bones about that. We've given a lot of flack to the baby boomers for some of their attitudes on things, especially the nostalgia element and how that sort of shapes some of that generation's politics. Again, we're painting in broad strokes here, but people are just going to have to live with that for the purposes of the discussion. But again, I think there's also those Gen X people who, you know, grew up under Reagan. Things were really bad, and then comparatively things were better under Clinton. So I think a lot of them then associate Clinton as, like, you know, a genuinely positive force, and maybe for the time period he was. But, you know, in hindsight, a lot of the things that he quote unquote got done in his administration have ended up having really harmful effects in the long term. I mean, obviously there's the criminal justice reform issues that ended up, you know, helping to spur a lot of the mass incarceration, which was sort of an extension of Reaganite policies from the actual Reagan administration. But then there's things like welfare reform that was, you know, supposedly this big achievement that has generally been very toxic, and the number of people who are really surviving on just, you know, dollars a week or whatever has risen. But I think the other thing too is that whole, like, market-oriented approach and trying to, you know, say, yeah, we concede that the government is bad and has been doing a bad job, which is essentially what Clinton, that's the case that Clinton made. You know, that sort of concession, maybe there were some short-term gains as the economy improved, but man, those were not secure gains at all. I mean, you can look at so many studies and research papers and everything on, you know, especially gains by African American families in particular, and to a lesser extent Latino families. You saw them moving into the middle class from, you know, working class or, you know, genuinely very poor, moving into the lower middle class throughout the Clinton years, and then sliding right back in under George W. Bush. And honestly, I'm not going to put that off on George W. Bush 100%. Like, George W. Bush has some share of responsibility, but the fact that it was that easy to backslide, you know, when the 2007 recession hit especially, and evaporate all those gains completely, like literally put them back to square one, early 1990s, that means that whatever Clinton was doing was not good enough. It was not actually securing anything. And so, you know, that kind of reconfirms this idea that Clinton is not actually this, you know, brief golden age of the 90s. He's this, you know, extension, milder version of Reaganism, unfortunately. Again, you know, maybe he was what was feasible for that time period because of the way that Reagan had framed the debate. I don't know. But I think we need to be careful about then extending that infinitely into the future, as I think some, you know, even as these Gen X progressives you know, who are very active and involved maybe are at risk of doing, in my opinion, which is to just assume that it's always going to be like this, right? That, you know, oh, because we haven't been able to do this for 30 years, or we've been trying to do something for 20 years or 25 years, and it's failed every time, that that means that it will always fail and it's never going to get done, or that it's going to take 30 more years to get done. No, I mean, that's not how American politics traditionally has worked. Usually there's a giant sea change, and there's a whole disruption, and a new cycle comes in, and things, you know, go back to being the other way, right? So potentially we're on the precipice here of going back in a more left-leaning direction, or potentially into an entirely new direction. We've talked about that as well on the show, you know, given the way that the world has changed, you know, what's the next big step in economics and governance? But, you know, this idea that it's always going to be like this, you know, I think that leads to a lot of cynicism. It's like an apathy. It's an engaged apathy. Instead of, you know, not turning out to vote, you are turning out to vote. You are volunteering for these candidates. You are, you know, running for office. You're doing all these things you're supposed to be doing. But with this attitude of like, the best we can hope for is to mitigate the damage that the other side is doing. The best we can hope for is to try to protect these programs as much as we possibly can. Not to expand programs, not to, you know, build on them, not to, you know, invent completely new programs, but to just, you know, play defense as hard as possible. And that, I think, is really limiting for what we can do. Yeah, it may well be that what Clinton did was entirely what was possible in the 1990s. But that doesn't mean that that's what's possible, the only thing that's possible now from the left. We may, in fact, have reached some sort of a breaking point where suddenly a whole bunch of things that for 30 years have been off the table are suddenly going to be on the table again. And we need to be ready to seize that moment if, in fact, that's what's happening here.
Yeah, that's a great point, Bill. I mean, we sort of fall into this trap in terms of thinking about the politics of like 10, 15, 20 years ago and then extrapolating that to today. But the thing is, there's, you know, tremendous amount of factors that go into shaping what the political reality will be of today. And, you know, we can't just continue following on these cues from, you know, the Hegelian dialectic of the Reagan years, where you sort of have, you know, Democrats and liberals fighting with conservatives to appear more free market than them. So we're now beginning a transition away from that, hopefully, and, you know, beginning a dialogue where it's not just, okay, how can we best serve the free market? It's, okay, how can we balance these competing interests in terms of providing for necessary things for people, and also, you know, trying to make the government work effectively and efficiently, and also trying to make sure that there's continued economic growth and free market is relatively unrestrained and prosperous. So these are, you know, we just need to be able to think about it in different ways rather than just the one way with, you know, the trickle-down economics of the Reagan era.
I agree absolutely as well. I think that was very well put. And I even find myself often, or not often, but occasionally a victim of engaged apathy. I like that term. And when I think about that engaged apathy, the first issue that comes to my mind is gun control and just the quite honestly, it's exhausting to see these horrific events every other week on TV and just really fighting off the urge to believe that there is nothing we can do about it, that the NRA owns us and this is the way it is. That issue is just one that really gets to me. It gets to a lot of people, clearly. But that, you know, what do we do about it? How do we advocate for actual what our country actually needs instead of advocating sort of for the littlest possible thing that we could do? Like, I mean, our country needs more mental health services, that is for sure. But these school shootings, that is not the only issue. But that sort of seems to be like the cheap line often after these events. So it is definitely difficult to sort of fight off the appeal of apathy in these trying political times. But I certainly hope that this new day you speak of comes sooner rather than later. And I hope that the American people are ready to have these big conversations about what our country needs.
When we come back from ArsenalForDemocracy.com and WVUD, we'll be talking first about the situation in Afghanistan, and then we will be talking about the Perkins Loan Program in the United States. So stick around. There's more just ahead from ArsenalForDemocracy.com. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate, and on the line with me is Kelly. We're going to talk now about the U.S. airstrike in Kunduz that's very controversial. This is in Afghanistan. Nate, what happened in this incident?
Well, there was a camp or a hospital for Médecins Sans Frontières, which is Doctors Without Borders, an organization that goes into war zones or other areas that have a tremendous amount of refugees or suffering, and you know, tries to help those people out. And there, it was bombed by a U.S. Airstrike. I don't know if it was drone or
it was an AC-130 gunship, which literally just stayed over the hospital at close range for a half an hour, bombarding it.
Okay, well, I did not know that. That is puzzling.
Certainly, yes.
To say the least. I mean, it's one thing if there's like a missile that like went off course or something, or like the wrong coordinates were input, but okay, that's something else. 33 people are still missing as of a couple days ago. There were 12 staff and 10 patients confirmed dead. Basically, it's been condemned all around the world as basically a war crime, which, you know, generally attacking hospitals is considered a war crime, so I don't think that's particularly controversial. Barack Obama has apologized, said it was a mistake. Now there's been probes by U.S. military, NATO, Afghan officials trying to figure out why the mistake happened.
The story here keeps changing. I mean, you know, we've established at this point that it was one of these big gunships. It was not an errant strike. This was a half an hour of sustained attack on this point. Doctors Without Borders, unlike many of the things that the U.S. has hit in Afghanistan or places like Yemen or whatever, is a target that has a loud voice and a large platform globally and a lot of respect. So when they get in front of a microphone and say things, more people are listening to them than, you know, your average Afghan civilian or Pakistani civilian or Yemeni civilian. And I think that's a good thing in this case. It's unfortunate that other airstrikes similar to this have not gotten as much attention. But they are basically saying that all of the NATO powers knew where the hospital was. This was reported information that they had provided to, you know, the U.S. and everything. The Afghan officials knew where it was. There's been conflicting versions in the U.S. account saying, you know, at one point, oh, the Afghans called in the airstrike. They said that the Taliban had run into the compound because the city had been basically taken over by Taliban fighters, and that, you know, this was, you know, bombing this target because of these fighters there. But again, half an hour is a long time to be striking this target, especially if you were supposed to know it was there. And there was debate over, did the U.S. special forces on the ground call it in? Did the Afghans call it in? They've gone back and forth on this in the official accounts. Doctors Without Borders is saying that they immediately, you know, sent a distress call saying, we're being hit by something, whoever's doing it, please stop. And again, this was ignored for quite a period before the bombardment actually stopped. I think that there's been this rush to just brush it off. You know, oh, it's war. Stuff happens. Well, okay. But I recognize that unintended things happen, and we can question whether or not this was even unintended or at least fully unintended. But, like, this is not an outlier. I literally heard one former, I think he was a general, on a radio interview. You know, the Department of Defense always rolls out all these former, you know, officers to basically give the official line before anything happens. And this guy said, oh, we should definitely have a U.S. investigation of this. The U.S. is really good at investigating accidental airstrikes in Afghanistan because we've had so many of them. And I was just like, oh, that's your line of reasoning?
That's good.
Like, and that's the problem here. Again, Doctors Without Borders has a loud megaphone to be able to be like, this is outrageous. All these other people that have died in these airstrikes don't have that. And you even get, you know, Afghan politicians saying this airstrike was justified. If there were Taliban fighters in the compound, it doesn't matter. Just blow it all to hell. Like, you know, so they're not even helpful either. So if you say, because this, you know, U.S. officer, former officer saying, oh, yeah, ask the Afghan officials. They'll tell you the U.S. does great investigations of all its accidental airstrikes on civilian targets. It's like, okay, but they clearly don't care. So a very troubling situation, certainly. Kelly, what was your reaction to this story?
It's obviously horrifying. That would be the human reaction. If anything good were to come out of this, as you've been saying it would just be that these people, the Doctors Without Borders organization and the victims of the airstrike, you know, have their day where the U.S. is held accountable for this sort of action, and that this, the fact that this sort of tragedy is not unusual, it's unusual in the fact that it happened to Doctors Without Borders, so that other tragedies of this kind are brought to light. I think that's the only good possible thing that could come out of this, because obviously it is a human tragedy and an embarrassment for the U.S. military over there, and just another sign of how sort of how poorly this our whole policy in the Middle East is really going, and how this type of tragedy and accident will continue to happen again and again until we make some serious changes to our Middle Eastern policy. And if this tragedy brings up that sort of conversation, that would be a good thing. So I hope that Doctors Without Borders continues to keep the pressure on the U.S. government to answer these tough questions. And while I understand that it is a military operation and military operations are messy and not pretty and unkind, I do think it's time we take a look in the mirror as a nation and decide what are our policies really going to be over there regarding this kind of accident or not accident.
Yeah, the hospital, okay, so it apparently conducted 6,000 surgical procedures and 20,000 consultations last year. 13 doctors opened 4 years ago. Basically, it was fairly high tech is what people are saying. You know, they sort of have these like medical centers in the mountains that aren't particularly equipped, but this seems like a pretty high tech facility. And from what people are saying, specific areas were targeted, including the emergency room, blood bank, all sorts of, you know, the critical operations, physiotherapy, intensive care unit. These were all targeted, hit several times, and no other buildings were hit, you know, in the surrounding area. So, I mean, these are just sort of the things where you sort of scratch your head and say, like, how did this happen? This doesn't really make sense. And some of the details that are coming out aren't exactly allaying some of our concerns and our fears. And it'll be interesting, if maybe not particularly illuminating, to see the results of some of these investigations.
Quote unquote. Yeah,
exactly.
Why did this even happen? Like, how were we even there? I mean, this I knew we were there, but the Obama administration fundamentally misrepresented this case, saying that the U.S. had left Afghanistan. That's not true. We still had a lot of people there on the ground. We still had this, you know, potential air presence and everything. As soon as the city of Kunduz fell to the Taliban, we were right back in the thick of it. I think that a lot of people really bought the hype that, like, the U.S. had withdrawn from Afghanistan, and that just wasn't true. And it's so frustrating that we're not actually leaving these situations. We're just there indefinitely. I mean, no, it's because this is the problem. This is perfect fodder for conspiracy theorists, and it's hard to write it off as conspiracy theory. I mean, the U.S. operations in Vietnam, there's all kinds of reports about how the U.S. bombed hospitals in North Vietnam intentionally. And, you know, there's some people are going to say, well, did they think that the Taliban was basically going to get control of the city, not be, you know, kicked out again, and was going to then have a high-tech hospital that they had control of? I mean, like, there's so much potential for conspiracy theory here. And then you're like, well, what are we even doing there? It doesn't make any sense. Why are we still there? We are basically fighting against the Taliban, the former government of Afghanistan, in defense of the Northern Alliance-backed government of Afghanistan that we installed in 2001 without broad popular support or a strong mandate, right? So we're fighting the former government against the current government, which displaced the previous government, which also itself displaced the previous Northern Alliance government, which replaced the Soviet-backed government, which replaced the Marxist government that preceded it, which displaced the monarchy. Like, what could this possibly have to do with us? It has nothing to do with us. Our activities in Afghanistan have been a complete failure, as every other empire's efforts in Afghanistan have been, and there is no point for us to be involved on any of these factions. We're not accomplishing anything there.
Bill, we did help create the Taliban, so that's another point in our favor there. We've got some connections there, so it's not like we're completely uninvolved or uninterested?
I mean, it's just, it's nuts. Like, we didn't build schools. We lied about how many schools we built. We've, you know, we're bombing hospitals. We, you know, the legal system and legal rights have been significantly rolled back even while we still had troops there, even in the areas we controlled. So you can't even make the argument that, like, we liberated women from the Taliban or anything like that. I mean, that's using women as a prop. That's not actual legitimate, like, militarized feminism or whatever. Like, this is, it's a complete joke. The U.S. operations in Afghanistan have been a failure. I don't know why we're still there. We're basically just participating in a factional fight between several different factions here, where none of them is really the good guys, quote unquote. I don't know what the point of this is. And that's, I think, the point that Kelly was making as well. We got to let Nate get going here. And then I'll turn to Kelly for the next segment. Nate, thank you so much for joining me here in studio.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bill. Great to be here.
Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. It's Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still on the line with me from Washington is Kelly. We're going to talk now about the Perkins Loan Program, which has expired after a 57-year run. So, Kelly, you wrote about this on our website at arsenalfordemocracy.com. Walk us through what is this program and what has happened to it that seems to have caused its demise, untimely or otherwise.
Absolutely. So the Perkins Loan Program was, until October 1st, the longest running student loan program in the country. And it was originally designed to serve the neediest of the neediest students. There are quite a few federal grant and loan programs around the country, but this was really supposed to help the neediest students. There were some questions about the structure of the loan, just because it tended to give more money to students at more expensive institutions. There was definitely room for improvement in the structure of the loan, in my opinion. However, the truth is that it was providing a bit of money to students all over the country. And it was set up in an interesting way, something that you would think fiscal conservatives would be on board with, because essentially colleges were given lump sums of the money. They hadn't been given a lump sum of money since 2005, and they distributed it to students as they saw fit using their own formulas. And students repaid back the universities, which, by the way, matched the government, which paid for a third of the loan money, gave 33 cents for every one of the government's 66 cents. So that was unique in the fact that the students, as they paid back the universities gave that money to pay for new students coming in. There was an option for students to be granted loan forgiveness after 10 years of working in the public sector as a teacher, a public defender, that sort of thing. And at that point, the federal government would come in and pay that loan and forgive the student's loan. So that is how the Perkins loan works, why it is unique. It has now expired as of October 1st. And I think the real story here is that there hasn't been much of a story, hasn't been much attention given to the expiration of this loan. Senator Bob Casey has been trying to put, from what I have read, it has been pushing the hardest to get, and is still trying to get, an extension for these loans, so that it does not affect current students who are getting the money. However, the biggest argument against extending this loan program is that there are many Republicans who would like to streamline the process for getting government grants and loans for students. Streamlining the process, I think, is a very good idea. I would love to see that happen. However, the truth is there's been no real proposals for that. So in the meantime, they've stopped this funding, prevented students from getting these loans. There's no real position on what to do next. Streamlining it sounds great, a great soundbite. I'm sure Reagan would have liked it, but no action steps to make that a reality. So students are left out in the cold, and there has been very little news coverage from what I've seen over the past few weeks.
and the students will suffer for that.
So there's no effort on the horizon, as far as we know, for restoring or replacing this loan somehow.
No, Senator Bob Casey is trying his darndest to get some traction and extend the loan, but there is nothing that indicates to me that that will actually happen.
How do you think that this ties into the broader sort of discussion that's been getting louder and louder about student loans, student debt, the role of the government in this, and also the role of schools in this? Because this is, as you said, an interesting program where the schools are on the hook for some of the money involved in these loans.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that part of the reason that many people are calling for the streamlining of government loan and funding programs is because we as a country need to have a bigger discussion about the cost of higher education, the worth of the higher education that our students are receiving, and need to create a long-term goal. I don't feel that old, but now as my younger sister is looking at schools, and it is not uncommon for a school to cost $70,000 a year, and that of course includes room and board and tuition, I am like, holy cow, the cost of college has been exponentially growing. We do need to have a larger conversation about that, but what I am not in favor of is stopping these programs that are currently helping students while we have that conversation. I think it's unfortunate that this program has ended. I do hope to see a discussion about the cost of college education and how our citizens are able to pay for it, but I don't think this is the way to go about it.
You mentioned that there hadn't been a lump sum made since 2005. It also seemed like other elements of this program, as important as it was, were definitely getting creaky, I guess. Like you mentioned in your post about sort of the funding models being potentially outdated, that was a point of criticism. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly room for improvement in this loan. That is not something that I disagree with at all. The funding model was sort of an interesting one that was set about, I believe, in the 1980s and was based on the cost of college in the 1970s and really hadn't been adjusted. So you saw certain institutions, namely expensive urban institutions, receiving a lot of funding based on the model that they had set up 20, 30 years ago. So, I mean, there was room for improvement, but there were students who benefited from it every year. So I'm not sure that getting rid of it was the best form of improvement.
So you've mentioned several times in this segment that there were students who were still depending on this program, even if it did have its flaws. So I wanted to kind of put, before we close out, put a number to that, which is something that you brought up in your post. On average, how much are low-income students going to be basically caught short this year because the program was not extended on October 1st?
Undergraduate students were eligible for $5,500 a year under the loan, graduate students $8,000 a year. The average undergraduate student who was receiving the loan was receiving about $2,000 a year. However, if that money is pulled, that creates a gap of $2,000 in a low-income student's financial aid package, a gap which educational institutions have indicated they're not able to fill in, no other federal program for these students to fill in. So you're asking a lot of 18, 19, 20-year-old kids to come up with $2,000 more to pay for their college education now that this program has expired.
And on very short notice, too.
Yes.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining me this week to talk about all of these issues.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.